Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have all good martinis. You could even say they're great martinis today. Good, good, and good across the board. Jim joins us today by phone. He's up in New York doing some work for CNN. Jim, other than maybe after the 2010 or 2014 midterms and maybe a couple other days along the way, I'm not sure we've had a better lineup of martinis than this one.
Greg, we are making martinis great again.
Well, let's start with the great news that broke this morning, although we got a little bit of a foreshadowing of it yesterday when the president made his public statement about getting out of the Iran deal. Foreshadow there. Here's what the president said towards the end of that statement.
In fact, at this very moment, Secretary Pompeo is on his way to North Korea in preparation for my upcoming meeting with Kim Jong-un. Plans are being made. Relationships are building. Hopefully, a deal will happen. And with the help of China, South Korea, and Japan, a future of great prosperity and security can be achieved for everyone.
And then as the president was signing a memorandum there, a reporter asked what the status was of the prisoners since there had been talk about them getting released. And the president said, "We will see. This morning, we know for sure." President Trump's tweet, "I am pleased to inform you that Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is in the air and on his way back from North Korea with the three wonderful gentlemen that everyone is looking so forward to meeting. They seem to be in good health. Also, good meeting with Kim Jong-un. Date and place set." The president will meet that plane at Andrews Air Force Base early tomorrow morning. So, Jim, we had talked about this last week, kind of thinking that this was already in the works and playing out with these prisoners to be released. Now we know it's official. As you pointed out on Twitter this morning, if this is all a big charade by the part of the North Koreans, they're really invested in this charade. But the fact that these Americans are on their way home is great news, regardless of what's going on. And it certainly sets the stage, hopefully, for something even bigger.
I was going to say, you almost wonder if you can lean into a feint so hard that you begin to forget that it's a feint. If this is all just a bunch of small gestures on the part of North Korea to build goodwill ahead of the summit, you know, they're starting to add up. They stopped, testing their missile launches over the Pacific, but that's the sort of thing they could pick up again at any point if they wanted to. They haven't done any nuclear tests in quite a few months. Assuming their test facility is still functioning and hasn't been crushed by a mountain's worth of radioactive rubble, as some reports indicated, that they could theoretically then do that one more. They could, start that up again. They met with the South Koreans, which was remarkable to see the two men embracing. But obviously that's, the sort of thing that's not a lasting commitment. That's not a permanent change. But in the case of returning hostages, okay, now they're starting to give something tangible. Now, I shouldn't necessarily break out the party hats for forever, because if any Americans are in North Korea, they are all potential hostages at any time when North Korea feels like it needs more leverage. The fact that they've demonstrated they've been willing to take hostages in the past indicates that they could do it again. But this is still a genuine, good, really good news for these three American citizens. It is a goodwill gesture on the part of the North Koreans, and I think they're starting to add up. The possibility that this represents a genuine change of thinking in Pyongyang's approach towards South Korea and towards the United States is a distinct possibility. We'll see how this shakes out, but the good signs of North Korea, small as they are starting to add up and starting to give a reasons for genuine optimism about this upcoming summit and continued U.S.-North Korean meetings.
Absolutely. We'll see what the actual details of that are. I'm sure we'll find out pretty soon, given Trump's tweet today. So, Jim, enough foreshadowing. Let's move to our second great martini. As most folks are aware, yesterday President Trump did what I think he's wanted to do since the day he got into office, and that is get out of the Iran nuclear deal. Here's what he said.
After these consultations, it is clear to me that we cannot prevent an Iranian nuclear bomb under the decaying and rotten structure of the current agreement. The Iran deal is defective at its core. If we do nothing, we know exactly what will happen. In just a short period of time, the world's leading state sponsor of terror will be on the cusp of acquiring the world's most dangerous weapons. Therefore, I am announcing today that the United States will withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal.
Yep, and the economic pain is back.
In a few moments, I will sign a presidential memorandum to begin reinstating U.S. nuclear sanctions on the Iranian regime. We will be instituting the highest level of economic sanction. Any nation that helps Iran in its quest for nuclear weapons could also be strongly sanctioned by the United States.
And Jim, I'm not even sure you could refer to this next quote as a thinly veiled rebuke of the Obama administration. I think it was completely unveiled.
Today's action sends a critical message. The United States no longer makes empty threats. When I make promises, I keep them.
So, Jim, you and I still remember this from 2015, going over all the reasons why the Iran nuclear deal was pointless and perhaps very much harmful because of all the loopholes in the inspections, can't go on military bases, can't find new sites if it's not already listed in the deal and so forth, heads-up notices and all sorts of other things, not to mention the ballistic missile programs not even included. There were more holes here than a Swiss cheese factory. What do you make of Trump finally getting out in the way that he did it?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. It's interesting how you would have figured it was the sort of thing that Trump would have opposed from day one. But there was, you know, significant stretches of Trump's first year where he kept renewing the deal, reflecting the influence of Rex Tillerson, saying that Iran had so far not broke the deal and that as far as the U.S. State Department was concerned, Iran was holding up its end of the bargain and there was no reason to walk away from the deal. Unsurprisingly, many of the people who were telling that to Rex Tillerson worked in the previous administration, had worked on the deal themselves, and you could argue had a pretty strong incentive to look at the deal in the most positive terms. But the flip side of that is that many people on the right expected one of the benefits of electing Trump would be getting out of this deal. If the deal had been on different terms, it's easy to imagine other folks on the right or center of the political spectrum finding it more workable. But in the end, you know, Iran got a very big economic benefit out of this. The elimination of most sanctions, the ability to really rejuvenate their economy, build up cash, including literal pallets of cash as part of the settlement of the seized assets or military equipment that we never sold to them after the Iranian Revolution in 79. And, the entire kind of concept of the deal relied on the idea that this was going to put a pause on the Iranian nuclear program for about 11 years. And the hope was at some point in that intervening 11 years, the character of the Iranian regime would change if the Iranian regime itself hadn't changed. There was really no sign of that occurring. And I think, you know, most of us would say that even if you had reason to believe the Iranians were going to hold up their end of the bargain, which was kind of difficult to do when you didn't have an anywhere, anyplace, anytime inspection regime. You had a anywhere, anyplace, anytime, the Iranians say it's okay inspection regime, which is, you know, if you're trying to hide nuclear program, that's, you know, not exactly the most effective setup there. In the end, they just got more aggressive. They got, you know, more. We may recall them taking U.S. Sailors hostage shortly after the deal was ratified. There was really nothing to indicate the mullahs were mellowing out, getting more moderate, willing to play nicely with the rest of the region. In fact, if anything, they very much had put Saudi Arabia and Israel and most of Turkey and most of the rest of the region on alert with the possibility of, you know, the U.S. kind of giving a tacit approval to a non-weaponized Iranian nuclear program. If you really want to defend this deal, by the way, Greg, I think probably the strongest argument is that it's made the Saudis and the Israelis get along a lot better because now they're shared together in a mutual fear of the Iranian nuclear program. So that's where we are on this. I think it was the argument, you know, when they say, I think it was Stephen Colbert last night who was fuming and saying, you know, you've just backed out of an American promise. Well, okay, there's a process called the treaty process. If you want to have a lasting agreement with another country, you submit it as a treaty. And they go, the argument from the John Kerry's of the world was always, it's just too hard. You guys in the Senate are never going to, you know, buy onto this. Well, you probably should look at why. And I guess suppose in their mind, every Republican in the Senate and a good chunk of the couple of the Democrats were just obstinate warmongers who were eager to go to war with Iran and too closed-minded in their thinking and all of that. But I think there's really good reasons to be very wary and skeptical of Iran and to not trust them to uphold their end of a bargain. So that's where we are. And I think it's, you know, after some, a little bit of doubt, a little bit of frustration, the sense that the Trump was not going to be a sweeping change on Iran as some folks on the right had hoped. He lived up to his word. The sanctions are going back into place. And I think if you're, I think it was Brett Stevens, the New York Times, who put it pretty well. He basically says, this is an ultimatum to Iran. You can have the thriving economy that you've enjoyed since the Iran deal went into place, or you can have a nuclear program, but you cannot have both. And considering their reaction to the deal and their threat to start enriching uranium again and lighting the deal on fire and lighting American flags on fire yesterday, I think it's very clear which one they would prefer to have, which is a higher, for them, the priority is a nuclear weapons program.
Yeah, we haven't said it a lot lately, but kudos to Brett Stevens for staying consistent on that. You saw John Kasich give a statement yesterday. He had been adamantly opposed to the deal in the first place, but now he's appalled that Trump got out of it. Same thing for columnists like Jen Rubin. On the left, I have to ask the question, Jim, do you think that not only the Obama administration alumni, but others on the left, and including in the media, are upset because they think this was really the best way to keep Iran from getting a nuclear weapon, or because it dents Obama's legacy?
You're putting your finger on it, of how much this became seen as an Obama initiative. And, because it was really interesting is that you could say, you'll see arguments like, oh, Trump is a very gullible negotiator. He doesn't, we don't trust him to negotiate with North Korea. He's diplomatically inexperienced, et cetera, which, we're giving them concessions and by agreeing to meet with them in a summit in North Korea, which, by the way, is a valid argument. You've heard from folks on the right before. But at the same time, insisting this sort of like I don't quite see how you can say, oh, yeah, I fully support the Iran deal, but I would not support a similar deal with North Korea under this president. And again, I think you're right. I think this has turned into a referendum on the Obama administration and their approach to Iran as much as the actual terms of the deal and the future of the Middle East.
Amazing. All right. Let's turn to domestic politics now. And Jim, Cocaine Mitch is happy today. He's very happy. I don't know what you do when you're really, really happy and you're throwing a big party, what could end up on the table and so forth. No, I'm just kidding. It's probably a glass of bourbon for Mitch McConnell. But Don Blankenship, the one everyone was so concerned about with those internal polls just a couple of days before primary day in West Virginia, not only finishes a distant third, we're happy to report that over 80% of West Virginia Republican voters said no to Don Blankenship. And we're excited to point out that Patrick Morrissey, the most conservative candidate in the race, who has won a couple of times statewide, he's the attorney general, did win the primary. He's going to be going up against Joe Manchin. So Republicans acted smartly and responsibly in West Virginia last night. In Indiana, we kind of foreshadowed this yesterday. The mudslinging congressmen, Todd Rokita and Luke Messer, both got blown out of the water by more than 10 points by the former state representative and I think one-time Democrat, Mike Braun, but he easily got 41% of the vote. He takes on Joe Donnelly. In Ohio, we got a governor's matchup between Mike DeWine, the former senator and current attorney general there, against Richard Cordray. He was the head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. He's kind of an Elizabeth Warren type there. So that'll be a fun race. And then in the Senate race, Sherrod Brown will be up against Congressman Jim Renacci. Most likely the Democrats probably are considered the favorite in that race. So, Jim, what are you most excited about what happened yesterday?
I think the single most exciting sight of last night is when the West Virginia results were pretty much official and it was all clear. Seeing the press conference in which Mitch McConnell came out and snorted just a mountain of cocaine. It was remarkable to see, Greg. And when he introduced Patrick Morrissey by saying, "Say hello to my little friend." No, that did not really happen. But it really should have. Shouldn't it, Greg? Wouldn't we have loved to see that? As is, he had put his Twitter account for McConnell's super PAC had put out, "Thanks for playing, Don," with white powder on the image. It was kind of, "Oh, you're going to call us cocaine, Mitch? Okay, fine. We're going to enjoy that." Look, it was a kind of fascinating look. Anytime we see Republicans avoid embarrassment, it's a remarkable achievement. We've set the bar that low. But look, actually, I think Patrick Morrissey is a really good candidate. The National Review endorsed him. I did a profile on him. The Clean Power Plan put forth by the Obama administration in about 2015. More or less was designed to gradually put the coal industry out of business. It was designed to promote alternative energy and basically make coal energy cost ineffective for electricity generation. Well, obvious reasons, the coal industry saw that as a, mortal threat, pushed back against it. But also, Patrick Morrissey, the state attorney general of West Virginia, led a legal argument against it, saying this is the EPA exceeding its authority that was never enacted to do. It was never set up to regulate carbon emissions because, carbon is produced by just about every human activity. Morrissey sued the Obama administration plenty of times. Didn't always succeed. But in this one, he did manage to get the U.S. Supreme Court to delay enforcement until the regular legal challenges could play out. This was in, you know, probably around February 2016, and everybody perceived it as a temporary delay of the program that would eventually be overturned by, you know, subsequent court decisions, and that eventually the Hillary Clinton administration would enact the Clean Power Plan. And then the election happened, Greg. All of a sudden, the Trump administration and Scott Pruitt had no intention of making that that plan go forward. And it's, for all intents and purposes, the plan as is dead. There's been a little bit of talk about whether Pruitt would put forth some sort of alternative plan that undoubtedly would be much friendlier to the coal industry. So if you want to say Patrick Morrissey saved the coal industry, I think that'd be a little bit of an exaggeration. He certainly had help, but he and his team are the ones who filed the court case and led the court case against this. And that he had a big role in ensuring the longer-term future of the coal industry, which is the sort of thing that should play pretty well in West Virginia. Now, does this mean Joe Manchin is toast? No, I don't think so. I think, you know, Joe Manchin's been a political survivor. You know, there were more Democrats who voted in the primary yesterday than in West Virginia than Republicans did. Not that shocking. There are a lot more registered Democrats than registered Republicans. But overall, Republican turnout was, you know, significantly higher in all those states, which is a pretty good sign. For Republicans, it's not been the trend you've seen in other previous primaries. Maybe that reflects that you had more competitive primaries on the Republican side. I think it the results in Indiana point to a very traditional, or not very traditional, but a common result when you see races get negative. When candidates A and candidates B really go at it, hammer and tong, and tear each other down, very often the biggest beneficiary of it all is candidate C. And that pretty much is what happened there in Indiana. And maybe it's a lesson to those who aspire to higher office, that you have to have a positive message as well as a negative message, and these things can end up hurting you that way. Overall, again, a little bit slightly brighter outlook for Republicans in a bunch of states after yesterday's results. A lot of road ahead, but you know, Republicans have good reason to feel slightly better about the midterm elections than they did 2 or 3 days ago.
Well, just going over some of what you said about the turnout, in West Virginia, Republican turnout up 61% over 2014. The Democrat turnout was up just 14%. And you mentioned the disparity in party registration there. That does not necessarily tell us how things are going to turn out in November. In Indiana, Republican turnout up 43% compared to the midterms of 2014. And in Ohio, the Republicans outperformed the Democrats in every single statewide race, with turnout up 48% over 2014. So we got some good matchups here. We've got some decent chances to win these two very vulnerable seats for Democrats in West Virginia and Indiana. If Mike Braun wins in Indiana, Jim, I would assume he'll be the most successful Braun in politics since George Costanza's childhood nemesis, Lloyd Braun, was working for David Dinkins way back in the day.
Wow, way into the way back machine for that reference, Greg. Well done. I'm sure both listeners in the New York City area will appreciate it.
And my last question to you is, even though Blankenship got crushed, does that mean we have to stop calling him Cocaine Mitch? Because it's kind of fun.
Oh, heck no. No, this is sticking to him for a long time.
Good. At least we got that out of it. I'd much rather have the nickname than Don Blankenship on the November ballot. So everybody wins. Jim, enjoy your time up in New York. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks so much for being with us today. And tune in again on Thursday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.